Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC doesn't just measure alumni engagement scores. It uses academic research in cognitive science and positive psychology to actually increase an alum's willingness to give. Quantitative data, such as capacity, gets a prospect into your pipeline, but qualitative data, such as impact stories, gets a prospect through your pipeline. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights and automatically delivers them to major gift officers for use in cultivation. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's training. If you're looking to align your entire team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about Responsive's four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, let's ensure that everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you prefer a virtual event, that'll work too. Let's get your team thinking critically and more carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I will also put some information in the show notes. Hi, David. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. You and I have exchanged messages. I think we talked about getting to, I think you're one of the last people I planned on getting together with when I was going to be in Tampa March of 2020, when right the whole world pandemic shut down, right?
Yeah.
And it's funny that I was planning on getting together with you, David, because I just did that engagement with the Tampa folks at their AAFP chapter last week in a virtual format. I mean, gee whiz, the world has really changed, hasn't it?
It really has. Who would have imagined in March that we'd be talking about all these Zoom connections that we're having to make?
Yeah. So, David, before we dive into our topic today, and I'm really looking forward to this one because I think in 200 plus episodes, we have not really talked about this distinction that you're going to help us draw for our listeners. Before we do that, how about you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
Well, thanks, Jason. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and appreciate the work that you do with the philanthropy community. And so the perspective I bring today is one of a former college president. I was president of Centenary College of Louisiana. But prior to that, I was vice president for advancement for LaGrange College in Georgia. I'm currently serving as an interim president for Lancaster Theological Seminary in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And I'm doing consulting work with the Association of Governing Boards around the area of adaptive governance and financial sustainability.
You know, David, I have not... I have not had a guest on here. Speaking of what we have talked about and haven't talked about, I have not had a conversation with anyone on the podcast in 200 plus episodes about interim leadership. And there was somebody who said something to me a number of years ago about this concept of intentional interims, very deliberate, intentional was the key word. Can you unpack that? I have to imagine that's a concept that you're very familiar with.
Yeah, this is my first time to serve in an interim role, and it's been interesting to observe the differences. You know, it's a finite period of time. I'm not auditioning for the long-term role.
Right.
Somebody else will come in and take that position. And so there's a specific defined set of expectations that the board gives to the interim, and if they've thought this through. And the interim works with the faculty and the senior leadership team to actually achieve those goals. And so as an interim, you don't have to really be defensive about the way things have gone in the past. And you really have to be invested in turning the decisions over to those who will have to live with the consequences beyond your tenure. So it really helps you communicate more, be more consultative and thoughtful about the impact of what you're doing, because you know that you don't have to live with the consequences of it. The others do. And so you want to make sure that they understand what the stakes are and that they buy into the idea that this is a good direction to go into. By the same token, you're not personally invested in the success or failure of it going forward. So the only thing you can do is give the institution your very, very best advice, your very, very best service, and help them understand what's motivating you and why you think it's the best decision for the moment.
Yeah, I have oftentimes thought when people have talked to me, because before I started doing my consulting work, I had interviewed for some interim type roles, and I had a mentor that was doing this type of work. And one of the things that he talked about was that the intentional interim sort of has the advantage of not getting their ego in the way, because you can sort of take some hits without, somebody, figuratively speaking, comes up and punches you in the gut today. You don't have to live with that forever. And that relationship, obviously you can mend that relationship, but what he was describing is this idea that the intentional interim can sort of come in there and help clean up shop, address some strategic issues like you're describing. The other thing is he talked about it in the context of it being which is fascinating to me, sort of like this constant sort of opportunity to sort of be in graduate school, if you will. I know you're an educator, so you get this. Right. It's like each one of these interim opportunities becomes like a graduate school experience. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, one of the things that, I mean, it's really interesting that you'd bring that up, because one of the things that we've been trying to do is learn together. And we've had a lot of things that maybe resemble more of a seminar than business meetings. And so you can actually engage people in thoughtful conversations about, what insights you bring to the table and what insights they bring to the table. Obviously, they bring the history, and they've seen the wheels invented before. And so they can help you understand that. And if you really kind of lower your own anxiety about that, you can learn whether or not the wheel was just provided at the wrong moment in the wrong context for the wrong set of circumstances and might work again now, or really isn't going to work again. And if you, really are consultative and listening to the folks who've been there for, in many cases, decades, they can help you kind of discern the difference between what was tried before and what you're trying now, and whether or not it's going to work in a new and different context. The other thing that's interesting about this is just the, you mentioned there are things you can do as an interim that you might not be able to do if you were here for the longer term. I mean, on the one hand, on day one, you're a lame duck. So that's, got its own provisional thinking that people have about the role you play. But on the other hand, there are things that would cost your successor political capital if they had to engage in those questions or changes early in their tenure. And so to the extent that the interim can help the community wrestle with some of the toughest questions that organizations are having to wrestle with right now, they can do so without necessarily worrying about what the cost is to their political capital, and hopefully set their successor up on a stronger foundation for going forward.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's Dr. Hupper is his name. I think that's some of what Dr. Hupper was sharing with me. He was sort of comparing it with that notion of what we've often talked about a level 5 leader. It's that leader who sort of sets up their their successors better to achieve far greater things than they could. And that's essentially what a very intentional interim is doing, is that they're sort of in this constant posture of being able to sort of say, look, I'll tackle some of these really hard issues so that when you come in, you know, when Sally or John comes in to sort of assume your role, they don't have to tackle that stuff. And so you've sort of cleaned the slate in some particular area.
That's right. Yeah. That's the best, I found the best way to position my own thinking and to try to help people understand my own thinking.
So David, you and I are going to talk about something. We could probably talk on that one for quite
some time. That's a good, well, I think that's an important topic that we, you know, could explore. Just the transitions that so many nonprofits and higher education and K-12 institutions are going through right now require that interim disposition, if not a formal interim leader.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we might have you back to sort of deep dive in. You know what? We'll have you back after you wrap up this interim experience. We like to get our guests back. So when you wrap this up at the seminary there, you ping me and tell me that you're done, and we'll get you back on here. But I'm excited about the topic that you brought to us this morning, because it honestly, David, it's not one that we've really talked about in much specificity. It's this difference between the asset and the income-based donor. So why don't you tee that up for us?
Yeah, well, you know, I think COVID has really, shone a light on development operations and has triggered a number of different responses to the moment. And early on in the crisis, I think development shops and the folks that were overseeing the development shops were a little bit nervous about continuing to ask for money. I mean, not only were our traditional means and methods of asking for money disrupted because we couldn't go to lunch with people anymore and we couldn't go and drop in on them at their office, we had to figure out new ways to connect with them. But we also, I think, at least had an initial reaction of being a little timid about asking for money. And that really, I believe, has forced a distinction that's always been there, but I think people should be more aware of now. And that's the difference between an income-based donor and an asset-based donor.
Right.
And if you track the stock market, the asset-based donors are doing okay. And so they really haven't been affected too much by the pandemic, at least not in a way that would indicate that by and large, the value of their assets have decreased. In fact, they might have increased so much that they may be facing new kinds of capital gains problems need to deal with. And so we shouldn't pull back entirely from the asset-based donors. And in my view, it's the asset-based donors that really do make and break campaigns. They really are the long-term transformative givers of an institution. And I think that that's important for us to stay connected with those folks. And right now, with so many added expenses coming into the ledgers for nonprofits and schools and colleges and universities, the asset-based donor can make a even more measurable and discernible difference than they were able to in the past. By contrast, I think that we probably should be rethinking our relationship with the income-based donor during this time and for the foreseeable future. And I think COVID really is causing us to think more carefully in colleges and universities about the value proposition that we offer our students and ultimately our alumni. And we've had this notion of education for a long time that we sort of rev people up for 4 years and send them out to the world and think that they're going to be okay. Especially those of us committed to liberal education. We think we've endowed you with all of the characteristics and capacities you're going to need no matter what career you choose. But the education or the economy is changing so quickly that people are really in a need even pre-pandemic for continuous upskilling and reskilling. And the pandemic, when we've graduated these people out into this really, really shaky economy, has highlighted the need for our graduates to figure out how to not only translate their degrees into economic success, but how do we actually become wind in their sails as they continue their careers.
Yeah, David, I think Yeah, I think that income-based donor is particularly interesting. And I think a lot of our, like the clients I've worked for, so you know this, I've worked with a lot of K-12 private schools, for example. And for the sake of our listeners, I sort of want to sort of create a profile of an individual that I think you and I are talking about, because we're really not talking. I don't think we're talking about, and you can certainly clarify if I'm wrong, but I don't think we're talking about that 25, 26 year old that's sort of oftentimes referred to as a millennial who's giving significantly, perhaps in within their sort of frame of economic framework, say on Giving Tuesday. But in a lot of ways, we're talking about that parent couple that I'm oftentimes interacting with at a private school who's perhaps late 30s, early 40s, and perhaps making the first four-figure gifts that they've ever made. And oftentimes I see it, and I certainly have experienced this, and you have too, in some of the when we sort of understand this when we're talking about work in faith-based organizations. They're sort of on that training sort of training, and you could almost call it discipleship sort of journey. They're learning how to give, and they're not giving five and six figure gifts yet. But if you don't train up that individual, and you don't sort of teach them what it means to, or permit them to sort of experience that, say, $1,500 gift, $2,500 gift that they participate in a capital campaign, they're going to sort of lose that spirit and that drive to become a very significant donor when they actually sort of turn the corner on that, when they become more of a quote unquote asset-based donor. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that's really accurate. And I have independent school experience too, as a president of a independent K-12 institution as well. And when you think about those parents, the ones you described, in many cases, they are managing a number of different expenses in their portfolio. And unless they, for some reason, have access to a great deal of assets, they're trying to work in that annual donation into other things, including tuition at your school. And
right, they're paying tuition. They haven't paid off the mortgage. I mean, if they're going to your private school, they're worried about, you know, tuition in higher education. They're just not your wealthiest donors. But once they get on the other side of that, and once they get into that asset phase of life, they're your ideal donors. So if you're not doing the heavy lifting now, you're really sort of missing the boat.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we tend to think of giving as an on-off switch. Either they're giving or they're not giving. But I think what you're painting is a really nice description of how people continue to grow, even into adulthood, over the course of their lives. They continue to grow with respect to their relationship with money, and they continue to grow with respect to their relationship to giving. And just like we all sort of start out with a tricycle, move to training wheels, and then to a bike. And I've never made it to a unicycle, but you know, you know, everything we've done in life, we've kind of grown into greater levels of complexity. And so you need to be able to kind of calibrate your appeals to where a person is in their developmental cycle relative to giving. And so, you know, early on, I think in people's relationship with giving, sometimes they're just interested in, you know, belonging, being a member. And so you see a lot of campaigns that, you know, IPTE at Clemson's probably one of the famous ones, you know, where you can demonstrate that you're one of the club. And yeah, then I think you see people grow out of that into more transactional forms of giving where, and this you have to help people grow through, where they feel like they're buying some kind of influence through giving. Yeah. And you have to help them think through the philanthropic dimensions of giving. And it's not the same kind of financial transaction that they make if they invest in a company or if they buy something.
Do you think that's problematic? That's probably where I have run into that the most. Yeah. Where I see that with I'm working on a campaign in Georgia right now, and we're interacting with a number of parents who are sort of in this profile that we're describing, still very much income based, but on the more affluent side of that sort of time of life. So let's say they're leaning towards sort of midlife. They own their own company, but the worldview is sort of still seen through what their monthly income is. But the contributions, for example, that they're making are often the biggest contributions they're oftentimes making. I can think of two or three fathers in particular that I've interacted with over the last couple of years with this particular campaign. You know, they're buying privileges to through the athletic programs at these colleges. You know, so they're essentially for this 45-year-old donor, we're creating a lot of transactional consumer-like opportunities, which when you're 45 years old and you're writing a $1,500 check, maybe that makes sense. But eventually when you're 65 years old and you're giving away perhaps 5 or 10 times as much money, you just can't sell them that much stuff.
I think as fundraising professionals, we really have to be careful about the distinctions between, you know, premiums and stewardship. And making sure that we are not kind of growing people that think that giving is always about getting.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've blurred the lines, I think, between providing good stewardship of generous donors and offering them premiums. And I think we have to, you know, I think that it's a stage that people go through, I think, when they give, and you need to be able to address that, but you also have to help them grow through that, I think, and help them to see the higher purpose of what they're doing. So even if they are getting premiums or perks for making gifts to the institution, I think it's incumbent upon us as fundraising professionals to actually help them understand the philanthropic impact. You know, how is this affecting the mission? We talked a lot, you know, a little bit about, you know, the K-12. You know, I'm a parent of a college freshman and a high school student, and you know, I'm inclined to give to the things that help my children. You know, so I understand why people, sure, you know, yeah, who have children in the band want to give to the band, but you also have to help people understand the way that this fits into the larger context of the mission of the institution and how it might help people beyond their child.
So what do you say? So let's hit the brass tacks here. So David, let's say I'm interacting with that 45-year-old donor who's got the capability, you know, husband and wife, they've got kids at the school that I happen to work at or whatever, 45 to 50 years old. I'm talking to both the husband and the wife. Say I'm on a Zoom call. They're perfectly capable of writing a $2,500 check. What's that conversation look like? And how is that perhaps different? Because I think this is really sort of the message you want to drive home today. I think that message, that opportunity, and sort of the long-term vision you're trying to sort of cast for our listeners is that it's not the same conversation you're having on like on Giving Tuesday, but it's also not the same conversation you're having with them when they're 65.
Yeah, so I think you need to think about where they are in their life and the way that they actually might be transitioning in their own lives and livelihoods. So yeah, somebody might have been living a fairly transactional life in terms of, you know, they put in whatever the system is, they're putting into the system and they're getting something out of the system. So whether that's work, whether that's investments, whether that's purchasing things, whether that's giving, but they're beginning to make that transition into the stage of life where they really want, they're starting to think about what difference are they making and what kind of legacy are they leaving. And you might even have that conversation with them around other aspects of their lives. You know, so, you know, what kind of leadership opportunities are you taking at work? You know, what other kinds of volunteer opportunities are you engaging in? How do you think about your life and what really gives it meaning? And to draw out from them their own values. And I think ultimately when you're moving people from this transactional stage into this difference-making stage, that you really want to begin to help them see how their values align with the mission of the institution that you're promoting. And then help them see explicitly the ways that their gift can not just advance the mission of the institution, but be a true expression of their values.
Is it And this is where, so in my seminars, David, I'm sure you've seen some of this. I talk about it a lot. We characterize these three lanes, and that messy, what I call the messy middle lane, that messy middle lane is literally designed for this 45 to 50 year old income based donor who long term will give in the most significant ways. But you've got to be willing to sort of do the heavy lifting on this relation. It's all about relationship, but it's also not about sort of this donor centered sort of customer service transactional stuff either. And I think this is where, I also think this is where fundraising professionals, different than anyone else in the sort of the whole operation, can really shine. Why is it that we tend to get this wrong? Is it because it's so unpredictable, and because it's not, because the margins aren't so high? Because when it comes to fundraising, if I'm critiquing anything, it's not our ability to acquire the new donor during Giving Tuesday. And it's certainly not our ability to get Grandma and Grandpa Johnson to give, you know, $1 million to the new building campaign. It's the fact that we seem to really drop the ball when it comes to this donor that we're describing here. What is it about our work that, what is it?
I think we have to work really hard to be countercultural in this sense. There's so many cues around us that would reinforce us to keep somebody in that position. I mean, maybe the biggest example, and you used it earlier, is college athletics.
Yeah.
And, you know, you hear people talk about, you know, I made a gift and I got my 50-yard line seat, but at the football stadium. And I also think that most everybody else within a nonprofit organization thinks that's the way every donor operates, and they think that that's the way the fundraising operation operates. And so, in some ways, they have a low opinion of us as being the merchants of perks, and we're trying to go out there and sell people influence, and many times CEOs of nonprofits will have this attitude that fundraising professionals need to help them understand is not necessarily true. And sometimes that means that fundraising professionals actually have to stand for the institution carrying on its mission despite a donor's request. And those of us in fundraising, you know, we know the donors best. And sometimes we might hear a donor preference, and somebody else in the institutional organization might hear a requirement that's been placed upon the institution by a donor.
Yeah.
It'd be easy for the fundraiser to acquiesce and begin to wield power by saying that these donors really want it this way. We've got to, you know, paint all of the, you know, walls yellow by tomorrow, or the donor's going to be mad. And so as fundraising professionals, we really have to do a gut check, continue to grow and be centered ourselves, and remember that we are conduits of two-way communication between the mission of the institution and the values of the donor. And we're not simply there to tell the institution what the donor says we have to do. But I think everybody else in the institution thinks that's what we do.
Right. And that's what I mean when I say I think the middle lane, the messy middle lane, is that place for us to shine, because we're actually being called upon by design, not by default, we're at the place in the relationship where we can shine in ways that every other part of the process really can't shine. Most of my listeners have heard me reference this story, but it's sort of the tragedy of exactly what we're talking about. So I was meeting with a grandparent couple in Fort Worth, Texas, a number of years ago, on a feasibility study. I'm certain you're going to appreciate this storyline, and you're going to be able to relate to it real easy. So I'm meeting with a grandparent couple. So they had put their children through the private school, and now their grandchildren are in the same private school. And I'm interacting with her, the grandmother and the grandfather at their lunch dinner table in their living room, at their home, private home. And I make reference to a gift, $1,500 gift. And I say, I'm saying on behalf of my client, thank you for this particular gift. Long story short, the grandmother says something to the effect of, we've never given a gift to the school. And what this $1,500 to her represented was, it was the $1,500 that she had basically spent at the gala, at the auction, 9 months, 12 months earlier to buy a washer and dryer. She was exchanging that $1,500 no differently than she would have if she'd gone down to the Sears department store and bought, bought a washer and dryer. And what I had to convey to my client in my report is I said, you're interacting with, you've got a 60, she had to be 65 years old. You've got a 65 year old woman here who has wealth, but she's never done anything but sort of purchased. She's never done anything but essentially been a consumer for you.
Right.
And you've never created. So let's say when she was 45, they were probably selling her stuff then too. And so I'm thinking, okay, at the point at which she can actually start doing things very meaningfully and very significantly and experience what real generosity is, it's too late because she's gotten into perhaps a 20 year habit of just buying stuff at your annual auction.
Well, that's a great point. I mean, I think that's one of the other places we have to intervene as well, is that you, in many ways, auctions and galas and things like that insulate volunteers and fundraisers and CEOs from having to ask the hard, intimate question about giving.
Yeah.
And so you will spend 364 days with a committee of volunteers who could each give $50,000 a piece, trying to figure out how this one auction is going to raise $50,000. And, you know, the
design, we inadvertently design, and sometimes, I think in some ways we're doing it very intentionally. We know that if we can spend all of our time and resources doing what, this is what I call that lane one stuff, very transactional, very consumer oriented sort of stuff.
Right.
We essentially avoid that uncomfortableness of realizing that high power mom or dad that's sitting on that committee with you, if you just take him or her out to lunch, start having a series of meaningful conversations, you'd raise five times as much money, but you don't want to get over that hump. And I think I think a lot of my listeners and certainly people that read my first book are starting to realize, these younger people that are coming into the work, I think they're realizing, this is what I think is the challenge and the opportunity in the fundraising profession. We've got people that are not quite 30 years old that have come into our profession and realize that if you can get outside of your comfort zone on this issue earlier in your career, you can go further, assure yourself more meaningful work, ensure yourself better compensation. But the problem is they keep running into bosses, boards and bosses that haven't developed the confidence with this stuff themselves.
Well, that's right. And that's what it takes. And so as you grow in the fundraising profession, you become more and more confident about helping your boards and bosses get there. And sometimes it might just be asking that board chair for a gift or, you know, in conjunction with your CEO and realizing that it's A, that your board is being asked by every other charity in town for a gift. And so they're, you know, they understand what this is about, and they're not as surprised by it as you might be when you first walk into that room, and help your CEO get comfortable. In fact, that's one of the things that I do, Jason, with college presidents. There are a number of college presidents that move into that role from the academic ranks and just haven't had that experience of asking folks for money. And it's almost impossible to be a college president now without asking folks for money.
Right.
And it's an unnatural skill set for a lot of us. It's just, you know, our parents taught us better than to ask other people for money. So you have to kind of overcome that. And so it's perfectly natural for us to think about how can we pour our time and energy into this event and, you know, raise a fraction of what we could if we actually spent significant time with the people that were planning the event or the people that we wanted to invite to the event or the people that we pray would come and be the opening bid at the event. You know, it's just a matter of getting over that level of discomfort that we have in having that kind of an intimate conversation with somebody about how their values might align with the institution and how money might be a really strong expression of those values.
You know, so I'm thinking about the interim engagement you got with your current partnership there. And I'm thinking that in some ways, because it's oftentimes these 40, let's again, sticking with sort of Sally and John, 45 year old, you know, graduates of the seminary there where you're at. Sometimes it's that warming up process that a person like you could sort of be focused on. I see in some of the similar work that I do that sometimes you're just warming up a culture to the idea of having these lunch table conversations that oftentimes sort of precipitate some of these more meaningful gifts. And you've just got to create a culture that sort of knows how to invite those people to the lunch table, to the coffee table, to right now it's probably a lot of Zoom meetings, right. But how do we relate to these people? And how do we relate to them? I think the other thing that sort of scares us about these, you know, late in their income side of life sort of donors, is because they're not as experienced, their expectations are really high. And they don't know what they're doing. I mean, it's like a kid in high school or college, you know, it's like a kid in college who's sort of nervous and sort of has all these weird, awkward expectations. It's because they've never navigated this stuff before. You know, I think about my kids, I got four kids, they're all teenagers. And sometimes you're looking at them thinking, and they're being really strange and awkward about some expectation that they have of mom or dad. And if you think about it, that's pretty much what a 45-year-old who's writing their first $2,500 check is sometimes doing. They're not really trying to be jerks. It's just they've never written a $2,500 check to anybody before.
They never have. Yeah. I mean, it's new for them. And, you know, it's something that you really want to celebrate and make sure that you mark it as something that's particularly meaningful. You know, you're linking that back to my experience here. One of the things that I'll take away from this experience that I've learned, again, I guess I've known it before, but I've learned it more profoundly here, is the power of listening. Yeah. And when you're in an interim position, you don't have a lot to tell. So you really have a lot to listen to. Yeah. And so I think both internally and externally with your constituents, there's an opportunity for the institution to pause and for somebody to be on behalf of the institution, actually listening to where these donors are and to understand what they're trying to accomplish, what's led up to their decision to make this gift, and to help the institution understand and interpret it as it goes forward. So much of the time we feel like we have to have the PowerPoint polished and the rendering, you know, perfected before we even go out and broach a donor about the possibility of giving. But being able to listen and even take some of the open-ended questions out to the people that you hope will invest in it later down the road is really important. So instead of taking a picture of the new building you want to build, go ask them the question early. Should we build a new building? You know, here's the problem we're trying to solve. Have you seen it solved in other places? Engage them in conversations so that they can actually understand the problems of that the institution is trying to solve before you come up and tell them that they're part of the solution. And I think people really want to be engaged in that way with institutions that they care about deeply. But a lot of times we skip over that first part of listening and asking honest, open-ended questions.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but there's also something about this donor that I don't think that we understand. So, you know, in nonprofit settings, we're always trying to get at that unrestricted gift, right? And I think we make the mistake of trying to get those unrestricted. When you're trying to get that unrestricted gift that say $100 that you're getting on Giving Tuesday from a 25-year-old, that's great. So it's unrestricted, but it's just not going to go very far. And then when you think about the unrestricted gift, you know, for somebody who's 65 years old, giving their first $1 million plus gift, perhaps, it's really hard not to have that pre-designated, right? It's pretty hard not to have that earmarked for something. But it seems like that if we could really do that listening that you're talking about, if we could sort of double down on the relationship aspect, I think all my experience has taught me that it's that 45 to 50-year-old donor, income-based donor, that if you can get the relationship of what it means to be a giver and a receiver in the exchange of money, you know, in the fundraising relationship, that's probably one of the places where you can get some of the best unrestricted multi-year and best sort of margins on your time type gifts. Am I right?
Yeah, I've been around fundraising long enough to remember when I think that we as nonprofit leaders made the mistake of actually interjecting the term unrestricted into the vocabulary. And I think we let the CFOs a little bit too close to the the chief advancement officers, and we learned this term unrestricted. And it's almost like we raised the question in the donor's mind, oh, I can restrict it?
Right. And so, it's an unnecessary selling point that you really don't. Right. But am I right, David, that I don't think the 45 to 50 year old at that particular point is really asking. I think that's the least likely person to want to restrict anything. There's too much going on.
I think that's why I think we have to be careful about interjecting that question into the conversation. Because you're really trying, like you said, if you're listening to them and you can align it with them, you're also building trust. And so when people insist on restrictions, a lot of times that's inversely proportional to the amount of trust that they have in the institution.
The more
trust they have in the institution and the leadership and the board, the more they will just release that to your control and say, we know that you're going to do something good with this. And so I think that's where that listening and trust comes along. And so that, especially for that person that's writing that first $2,500 check, like you said, sort of awkwardly, and it's not that they're trying to be difficult, but it's just difficult for them to do. If you take that and are in the true sense of the term a good steward of it, and show them that you've been a good steward of it, then I think it makes them feel really good about that awkward first step that they took, and they'll be willing to take a slightly less awkward second step.
And they very easily could be. And for any of my listeners, I mean, we've got models like this. There's actually a model that David and I are inadvertently talking about through this. They teach this in second and third and fourth year economics students learn that there literally is an income and an asset based side of life, usually around 55, 60 years old for most. Certainly most individuals live in sort of some of the, Western countries like we live in. And I think the opportunity that you and I are largely talking about, David, is if we can time our engagements with individuals sort of on that, before they sort of start edging too close to that line, we can develop that rapport. We can develop that trust. Is there a particular reason, last question before I let you go, is there a particular reason why now might be particularly timely for those individuals? Say if we're doing Zoom calls, I've got a client, I'm meeting with them tomorrow, and they're constantly asking me, what do we do differently? What do we do differently? And I'm like, look, take the same skills you'd use at the coffee shop and the lunch table and put them on a Zoom meeting. It's not rocket science. I mean, is there a particular reason why that 45, 50-year-old donor in your mind, who's giving $2,500, might be the particularly good donor to be talking to right now?
Yeah, because they're probably facing challenges that they've never faced before financially, and maybe some questions in their lives that they're facing, and they need to know that you're there for them, even if they can't write that $2,500 check this year, that your relationship with them is multidimensional. It's not solely about giving. And so if you're noticeably absent, like you think that your presence is actually a problem right now, then when you reappear after the pandemic, it's really going to be a problem. I would definitely recommend staying in touch and trying to understand and calibrate your ask to what you think that the level of security and confidence they have in their ability to either keep their job or keep their income where it is, or manage the expenses that they're having to go through right now. It's an extraordinary time, but I think staying in touch is more important than ever, and it's more efficient than ever. So you're clicking from Zoom meeting to Zoom meeting instead of driving across town from lunch to coffee. So you can get many more meetings in per day, and they can too. And so my clients are telling me that donors are even seem to be, now that we've kind of mastered Zoom, more open to getting together and talking than maybe they were when they had a busy calendar of folks coming into their conference rooms and offices before.
Oh yeah. We've talked about that with several guests just in the last couple of weeks. The idea that it's the platforms like you and I are sitting on here. Can you keep hold? I'm quite convinced, David, that we're going to see the disparities between the sort of the haves and the have-not organizations actually just get wider, because in this sort of this time period of perhaps social distancing, and when platforms like Zoom and like what you and I are on today, I think for some organizations, it's just going to become the rationale to which to double down on the cheap arm's length fundraising tactics. And for others, it's going to be the realization that, no, those skills that we used at the lunch table and the coffee table are twice as valuable now because we can double down on those engagements like you just described. We can do twice as many meetings on Zoom today. I can do four of those instead of two in person, and perhaps engage with that individual in a very meaningful way. There's something else about that donor that sort of occurs to me. It is that sort of that growing up. I'm thinking about this client that I'm working with in Georgia. And one of the fathers, for example, is like 47, 48 years old. And I think he's particularly aware of how well he has done for himself and set himself up to weather the current reality. Does that make sense? Like, he knows he's done well. He knows that he's creeping in. I guess he's creeping into that asset side of life, and he's realizing that COVID-19 didn't totally destroy him, and it didn't like unplug his future. And so there's a spirit. I guess what I'm getting at is there's a spirit of gratitude within the way you interact with him. He doesn't know how to write these really big checks yet, but he has that attitude of, I've done well for myself, and maybe it's time that I start paying that back. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think one of the things, you know, that's kind of a traditional campaign logic is that we do donor ratings, and we usually have two ratings, capacity and inclination, right? You know, there's more complicated ways of doing it, but it all kind of boils down to that.
Yeah.
And we spend all the time trying to do our research so that the only people that we're rating are the people with high capacity, and we're just trying to figure out what the inclination is or how we can develop that inclination over time. But there's a whole bunch of folks in our midst that have high inclination, and we need to be very concerned about developing their capacity. And developing inclination might take 18 months. Developing capacity might take 18 years. Yeah. And, you know, you have to be thoughtful about how you are participating in that donor's own process of professional development and wealth accumulation, and help them understand the capacity that they actually have. And, you know, this is when, you know, I think, you know, thoughtful interaction with financial advisors can be helpful too. And you begin to develop the capacity side along with the inclination side. And I tell you, if you're seen as somebody who helped a donor develop and realize their own capacity, the inclination part is going to be really simple. And so just they've known that you've been with them there for a long time. And this is another lesson from interim leadership, I'd say, Jason, is, you know, we all know that we are stewards of an institution and a mission for a short period of time. When you're an interim, you know when that begins and when that ends. Most of us don't know necessarily when our time with an institution is going to end, but it doesn't matter. It's only a small chapter in the history of that institution. And we're going to open the mail one day and get a planned gift from somebody we never met and celebrate it and be thankful that somebody took the time back when that person was a 45-year-old, $2,500 donor to care about them as an individual and as a family. And in turn, we need to be thinking about what we're doing today with the 45-year-old, $2,500 donor and how that person's going to grow and how that's going to be meaningful for the organization maybe 20 or 30 years from now.
Yeah. David, you and I can keep each other going. Sounds like we think a lot alike. We need to figure out some more ways to, when COVID does get out of our way, we need to think about some ways to collaborate together. In the meantime, I'm sure there's people who've listened to our conversation today, and they're perhaps interested in reaching out to you and saying, I want to keep a conversation going with, I want to start a conversation with David. How would you suggest that they do that?
The best way to reach me is through thedevelopmentpresident.com. Thedevelopmentpresident.com is my website, and it's got my blogs on there on development leadership. And it really does, it's grounded in this approach of growing donors as much as we're trying to grow revenue.
Yeah, I love that. I noticed that a year ago, the name of your website, it aligns with the, there's a chapter in the book that I, there's a chapter that never got written in my first book called The Fundraising CEO. And I knew when I saw that, I was like, this guy gets it. So it's certainly been a pleasure, David. You're always welcome back.
Thanks so much, Jason. Take care.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.